With love, we have this hot off the press news from the United Kingdom. There is a name for the brand new prince, and that is George Alexander. So those of you who are holding your breath waiting for that, you don't need to turn on CNN. You can hear all the news here. Thought of that just as Desi and Brad pointed out, this killer heat wave in England, getting almost no attention nationally, globally, nationally in this country, globally as well. While at least in this country, all the focus is on the birth of the prince, which, yes, is exciting, but does it warrant wall-to-wall coverage? Well, you decide. I am very happy to have D.R. Tucker joining me for at least the first segment today, and we have a lot to talk about. We're going to be finding out about a multi-state climate tour bus, and we're going to be interviewing somebody who is leading that in just a moment, a former representative from Virginia. And then we'll be finding out about protests that took place just this morning at Google headquarters. And there are many environmental activists, including our friends at Forecast the Facts and Credo, that are upset that Google is funding climate change deniers like James Inhofe. We'll check in and see what happened there. And then in the last segment, last but definitely not least, we're going to be speaking to a fabulous scientist and author and activist. Her name is Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's written a book called Spine of the Continent, and it's actually very intriguing, so stay tuned for that. First of all, I want to welcome DR back to the program. Hey there.
By George, the things people care about when they ought to be caring about more important things.
But having said that, we at least now know that Prince Charles has yet one more reason to be very concerned about climate change. He has been quite active, quite outspoken as a world leader on climate change for years, even before it was, quote, popular to do so. And now he has in flesh and blood, royal blue blood, that is, a real example of why we need to be concerned about future generations.
Yeah, he certainly doesn't kid around on that issue.
Okay. The hits just keep on coming. So why don't we, since we do have so much to cover, why don't we go right to our first guest? I believe he's on the line now. Tom Perillo, if I've pronounced it correctly, is the president and CEO of the Center for American Progress, the Action Fund there, and counselor to the center, one of our favorite groups, and Think Progress and Joe Rome as well. He previously served in the U.S. House of Representatives representing Central and Southern Virginia. And before politics, he worked as a conflict analyst and an advocate on environmental and poverty issues. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me and for that clever segue from the royal baby to climate change. That was well done.
We connect it always. There's always a green link. We see the world through green-tinted lenses, and we try to keep it current on all fronts, but mostly on the green front, hence the name of the show.
So it's effectively done.
Tell us about this multi-state I Will Act on Climate bus tour that you are a part of, how it came to be, what your role is, and when it kicked off.
Well, it's really a convergence of two things. First and foremost, as you've been talking about today and on other days, is just the moral urgency of climate change itself and the extreme weather we're seeing already come to pass, and knowing that this is only the beginning of what we will see in terms of the human costs as well as the billions of dollars in damage. And it's a convergence of that reality with a speech the president gave that I think is one of the boldest he's made since he came to office just a few weeks ago, announcing a comprehensive climate agenda. And as someone myself who was proud to have voted for the cap and trade bill, even though I was from a very conservative district, what he's laying out will actually do far more than cap and trade, if implemented, to address the very serious buildup of greenhouse gases, not just in the U.S., but globally, with the leadership of Secretary Kerry at the State Department now. And what the bus tour is saying is really trying to back that move and find support from the grassroots in to say we will act on climate change. As the president said, if Congress won't act, I will. And what you see is well over two-thirds of the American people want this to happen. They have seen this these weather shifts. We've shifted from a debate largely of whether or not this is real to anyone who walks outside their door understanding it is and saying, what are we going to do about it? So we feel like there's a moment here with the president willing to show some leadership, which has not necessarily been what people have felt from day one. You have Secretary Kerry, who just got a great deal, or the beginning of a good deal with the Chinese on the super pollutants. And this is a moment where I think we're trying to show not just the breadth of support, which is clear, but the intensity of support, which has somehow sometimes been the criticism. Are there people who are willing to vote on this issue, organize on this issue, make sure elected officials know how deeply we care? So I was down in North Carolina with the bus a couple of weeks ago, and you're really seeing business leaders, people from the agricultural community and the sportsman community, faith leaders and others who understand this as one of the great moral challenges of our time. So the bus is really an organizing opportunity to give voice to those folks around the country who care so intensely about this issue and bring that back to Washington.
Tom, first of all, thank you so much for your courageous vote in favor of the American Clean Energy and Security Act. And with regard to President Obama's June 25th speech, what did you make of that speech and specifically some of the criticisms of the speech? I know Josh Fox, the filmmaker behind the Gasland films, has pointed out that a lot of the speech came across as being excessively pro-fracking instead of calling for a direct shift to clean forms of energy, which is possible if there's enough political will behind it. So what did you make of that speech, and what did you make of some of the faults that some people found with the speech?
Well, as you know, if you get five environmentalists in the room, you'll often get five different opinions or maybe 10 on the priority, but they're things we all agree on. And they're great writers out there who are very focused on different aspects of this. And, you know, our belief is the answer to what needs to be done is whatever it will take to address the science that we know about the challenge of climate change and extreme weather. And the truth is, in some ways, it's already too late to fend off some of the changes. The question is, how extreme will those changes be? So I think we know that doing a very serious carbon rule on existing and new power plants would be a very substantial step. Continuing with some of the efficiency standards, that some of which have already been laid down and are already changing, not only the way the cars are being designed, but appliances and other things are important. If we did everything on the U.S. side and didn't deal with India and China, we still wouldn't be ahead of the curve, but it's hard to get India and China on board when we're not doing it ourselves, so we know these are dual tracks. The natural gas debate is obviously an intense one. We've just come out at CAP with one saying, with a report on the subject, and I will tell you after over a year of working on it, there is not consensus in this area, but I think that there is a lot more skepticism about it and a lot fewer people who are outright bullish about this as part of the solution, at least medium to long term, than you've seen a few years before. And I think that's partly the data that's been collected. I think that's partly organizing that's been done and the reality we're seeing in communities. So, look, I think it's always useful to continue to push the envelope further on this issue, given how serious it is. But I think that conversation can go on simultaneously with saying, with trying to lock down the legacy of putting some of these rules in place, including the carbon rules on existing and new power plants. And I think you are seeing that shift. We all know with any policy you have to worry about what the secondary and tertiary effects are. And for example, right now, if coal plants are phasing out or not being built, the most likely alternative right now is natural gas. And there are some very serious conversations. So I don't think we want to halt any of those. Obviously, the pipeline continues to be another issue that many environmentalists are deeply concerned about, where the president kind of it wasn't quite clear what was being said in the speech. So, you know, as an organizing group, it's not our job to back the president. It's our job to protect the environment and communities. But we believe that this speech was a good opportunity to say, hey, we want to lock down what could be some truly transformative rules that move the ball forward, while not in any way letting up on just how serious the scale of the problem is.
So you agree that the president's speech on climate change was certainly a good first step, if not second or third, but certainly hopefully a pivot point. But it's been long, you know, understood that what's really needed is this grassroots support, grassroots demand, the American people saying we want, you know, action, we want policies that are going to protect our climate. And that's why we're very interested in the bus tour, that, you know, town to town, city by city, state to state, getting in front of people. Do you have much information about their reception and the crowds that are showing up, or perhaps not, because it's not always easy to get people to come out for, oftentimes an issue they're not quite sure really concerns them yet?
No, it really has been quite a good turnout at the events, both the ones I've attended and the ones that I've been following by live stream and checking in with the folks on the bus, because I think you really are seeing some groups that are not just the usual suspects, though we certainly love the usual suspects. And you do see, for example, there were some sportsmen, people who run outdoor sports and also fishing clubs down in North Carolina, who are seeing this affect their business in terms of migratory patterns and other things. The agriculture community, which I think it's fair to say, has not always been 100% aligned with progressive and environmental causes, is starting to take very seriously the droughts. You see the Navy and ex-Navy folks who understand what this means for coastlines and ports, as well as some of the shipping folks. So you're seeing not just the very, very important work that traditional environmental groups and allies are doing, but you do see some of these other folks. And I think, one of the things that I try to keep in mind with this is when you're doing transformative politics and organizing, it often is iterative. It's not that you win the first time. And I think when you think about all the work that went into the ACEs bill, cap and trade, whatever you want to call it, and then there was this assumption that, oh, then everybody turned on the idea of green jobs. Well, that was a very elite turn. If you actually went out and talked to people, as I did, people were still believed, A, this was important, and B, that we could outcompete the world for these jobs. I was representing Southern Virginia at the time, and we were helping former tobacco farmers who were looking into biodiesel, people who were looking at the grow local movements, people who were turning cow manure, capturing the methane and turning it into clean energy. And when people see that this really works, it's a transformative thing, and I think they realize that the folks on the other side of this are largely just backed by oil and coal companies and feeding them false information. So the reality is we've got to keep going back to these arguments, and I like to cite, even though it's a little self-serving, even in a highly conservative district on election day in 2010, after they'd spent a couple $1 million bashing me for that vote, the voters were asked, who do you trust more on energy? And I won that by 24 points. And the reality is we have science on our side, but we also have morality and vision on our side. And so I think we can go out and make this case, and I think that's what you're seeing with the bus tour, is it's really bringing people out who feel this way. And I think one of the other, critiques is, again, how intense is the feeling? And I think that's the other thing that's shifted in our country. Now, you all have been living and breathing this for a while, long before it was cool, but I think there are a lot of folks who used to consider this, they were on the right side of the issue, but it might be a second or third tier issue, are starting to say, whoa, this has got to be a top priority.
Speaking of some of your former colleagues in the House of Representatives, there was an interesting op-ed a couple of weeks ago in Real Clear Science by a gentleman under the pen name of Eric Bradenson, who basically urged his fellow Republicans — he was apparently an aide to a Republican congressman — he encouraged his fellow Republicans to act on climate and to support a carbon tax. But, of course, the fact that he was anonymous and wrote the piece anonymously speaks volumes about the way things are going in the GOP. Do you think Republicans are simply too scared of the far-right wing and Charles and David Koch to take climate action seriously? Or do you think somewhere, sometime soon, they will finally, get off their asses and do something about greenhouse gases, as Betsy might put it?
Yeah, I think not to put too fine of a point on it, but there is a tremendous lack of courage and of statesmanship, or a less gendered version of that term, in this town. I'm calling from D.C. right now. And, I got called all manner of courageous for being a Democrat who supported health care reform and clean energy, which hardly feels like we're setting the bar very high, for what that takes. And there are a whole lot worse things in the world than being an ex-member of Congress, to be honest. And so we're not really asking great sacrifice from these leaders. And I think, that's the the moral reality of why I think it would be so great for some of the Republicans who know the science and they know the reality of this and they know the importance in terms of our national security to step up. I do think there's also a political reality. I think, you know, that setting themselves up as the anti-science party, as the Republicans have done for, you know, at least a decade now, is extremely dangerous in terms of their voting bloc in the suburbs and with women. It's also one of the main issues that has turned immigrant communities, both Latino and Asian in particular, against the Republicans. Asian Americans were voting majority for Republicans 15 years ago. And one of the top issues that's been cited in that flip is this is just a profoundly anti-science party. And so I think this is something we're seeing in the Virginia governor's race this year, where the business community that in recent years has lined up pretty solidly with the Republicans are actually backing, you know, Terry McAuliffe, who has a background in green energy and has taken strong positions on climate. And, you know, you see Ken Cuccinelli having trouble getting support from the business community, partly because he opposed a transportation bill that is, includes some desperately needed infrastructure investments. But also, I think the science issue, when many of the firms that want to locate here, often related to the defense industry, want people who are, you know, on the cutting edge of engineering and science and the like. So, you know, I think this is a very serious issue for the Republicans, though they do not often ask me for advice on strategery. But again, I think there's both a moral argument there as well as a political argument. And unfortunately, I think this comes back to any number of factors, including gerrymandering and the filtering of our news media that means that Republicans are often much more worried about a primary challenge than a general election challenge. But again, I feel like that's where statesmanship comes in, and people should say, hey, this is the right thing to do, and I'm going to step up and do it and let the chips fall where they may. Bob Inglis is certainly seen as one of the few who did that and paid a big price for it. When he was the Republican from South Carolina, he didn't vote for the bill, but he did recognize and say that climate was real, climate change was real. That, along with saying maybe Glenn Beck wasn't right about everything, meant that even though he had a perfect conservative voting record, he lost 4-1 in his primary. So, you know, that can be a real factor. But again, I think he walked away with his head held high and a tremendous amount of respect on both sides of the aisle.
Tom, in taking a look at your longer bio, very impressive. You're a graduate of Yale University, Yale Law School. You've written in many prestigious publications. Time magazine named you part of their 40 Under 40 series in 2010, citing your record as a, quote, unapologetic progressive. So I can't help but ask you, why are you not, well, your intelligence is showing, that's why you're not in Congress, but we need you there. What made you get out of politics?
Well, first and the most immediate cause was the voters kicked me out in 2010. Though I will say, you know, we were very proud to outperform the national average by 14 points, having stood up for these progressive causes. So, I walked away feeling like not only by standing up for your convictions do you walk away with respect, but you actually get people to bother to show up and vote for you, and we did stay very close. But, you know, I think one of the important things, and this bus tour goes to it, is there are a whole lot of different ways for people to make a difference on climate. Being an elected official is one. Helping people get elected is another. Organizing in your community, writing, researching, being a community organizer, being a faith leader, being a radio host, all of these are ways that you can make a difference. And I think many people in my generation, I'm still a little under 40, are, you know, have developed this sense of what we call social entrepreneurship, which is to focus less on what is the job title you have than how can you be a change agent within each space. And right now, sitting at the Center for American Progress, which is just a phenomenal institution, I run the advocacy side and again, counselor for policy on the think tank, but, you know, get to be a generalist working on a lot of issues I care about. You know, I spent much of the year after leaving Congress actually working on the Darfur peace talks again and with the Arab Spring developments and many of the revolutionaries in Egypt at the time. And so, you know, there are these justice struggles around the world. There's climate. We have an immigration struggle right now. We still have a tremendous challenge of social mobility in this country. I think many of the issues that drive our environmental problems also have cultural components, issues of instant gratification and being sort of very consumption oriented. So some of these things cut deeper. So to be able to be at an institution as unique as the Center for American Progress and, you know, our blog Think Progress and Climate Progress that that have such enormous pickup, in some ways I get to work on the same issues as I did in Congress, but without necessarily having people, you know, in my face in quite the same way or having to fundraise the same way. On the other hand, there is a unique, it's hard to really sum up what it means to get to represent your fellow citizens in a democratic experiment that has been going for 260 years now. There's something very special about getting to represent a community and an individual, particularly during what were some of the toughest times we've faced in recent memory. So lots of different ways to serve, and right now certainly anything we can do on climate, whether at CAP or in my personal capacity, I'm more than happy to do.
Okay, we are at a time. Unless, DR, you have a burning quick question for Tom.
Just one quick question. Any thoughts on Gina McCarthy's confirmation as EPA chief?
Good question.
Yeah, you know, I think that the most important thing is that we get this done with. She's off and running, and whatever the negotiations were around the filibuster and everything else, it's a shame when we have to put this much effort to accomplish something that really shouldn't have been a fight in the first place. But the reality is, I think at this point, the posturing has been done and everything else, and I think this is a very serious person who is going to come in and both know how to run the institution, which is an important part, and how to push the policy. So I think we're in a good place there. Certainly we and others have been very involved in looking at issues about the filibuster reform, et cetera. But what we need is leaders in these positions who can start to take the president's agenda and input from the public and move us forward. And again, I think McCarthy is going to do a great job. I also think in Secretary Kerry, we have someone who's just tremendously dedicated on the issue of climate and understands the importance of getting China, Brazil, India, and other countries engaged in this, and hopefully we'll be a bit of an asset back in the Senate, though I have low prospects for most things getting through the House of Lords. So we will see on that. But again, I think, you know, whether you get involved with iwillact.us, which is where you can follow the bus tour or follow Climate Progress, with all these developments, we're certainly going to be trying to do our part and set the boldest agenda we can.
Tom, I want to thank you for your leadership on behalf of D.R. Tucker and I. Knowing you are out there makes me feel better and more hopeful about our future on so many fronts. You're really quite impressive. So thanks again for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you so much. Keep speaking truth.
We will. We can't help it. And we're going to get some truth about a protest against Google, which is pretty unusual in and of itself. Google, generally seen as, you know, one of the more progressive companies out there, certainly a leader in technology. Emily Southard is joining us now. She's a campaign manager.